wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. I just heard some terrible news that 50 people were killed last night in a Las Vegas nightclub and over 200 wounded. The only thing I know at the moment is that it was a 64-year-old white man that committed the crime. Bill Resnick will be coming on later in the program to say a few words about this tragic event. Also on our program today, Denise Morris offers a recording of discussion that followed the showing of The First Daughter and Black Snake, a documentary film that led off the Portland Echo Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater last week. The film is about a proposed oil pipeline that threatens Native American sacred ground. It seems to be movie day on the Old Mole, as next up, Jan Hawken talks with psychoanalyst Bob Samuels about Darren Aronofsky's new film, Mother. The film is certainly controversial. Moviegoers gave the film an a rare F grade, according to CinemaScore, while many critics have lauded the film's originality and audacity, even while wondering just what it's all about. Stay tuned to find out. Leading off our program today, Bill Resnick interviews Paul Street. Paul Street is an independent radical democratic policy researcher, a prolific journalist, and historian. He's the author of several books, including his latest, They Rule: The 1% versus Democracy. Street has written a piece that was published in Counterpunch last week, The Meaning / Significance of the Athletes' Revolt, and the space it opens for reaching so many who are alienated and withdrawn from politics. The article will be the focal point of their discussion today. Bill?
Paul Street, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Paul, let me add a little bit to the introduction. Paul writes regularly for many journals, including Counterpunch and Black Agenda Report. From the year 2000 to 2005, he was research director at the Chicago Urban League, where he published a number of studies, The Vicious Circle, Race, Prison, Jobs, and Community in Chicago, Illinois, and the Nation, as well as Still Separate, Unequal, Race, Place, Policy, and the State of Black Chicago. Paul Street, the sports industry wants to portray sports as non-political. Oh, it's family-friendly, good, clean fun for players, all participants and fans. It's full of life lessons about leadership, teamwork, love of the game, and, of course, love of country that unites us. So in their language and their iconography, with all our diversity in this country, we can play and cheer the teams and the men and now even some women that we love, especially our hometown school teams, and then God Bless America, which is one of the themes of the Super Bowl and the flyovers by the Air Force. Paul, a lot of players don't accept this picture or their roles in advancing this myth of sports. So some began to speak out. Donald Trump, bless his evil heart, attacked them. The players responded, it's a big national controversy. Tell us about Colin Kaepernick and the great controversy now happening.
Well, you know, sports, it has no politics, and yet years ago I was visiting my son in Nashville. And I was at a hockey game there, and I had just sat down, and this wasn't even at the anthem at the beginning, and all of a sudden they trotted a veteran out. This was in the middle of the second period or something like that during a break. And I just noticed everyone in a knee-jerk kind of way had risen right up, and they were staring at me. I didn't even know what was going on. I was sitting there eating my nachos, waiting for play to resume. And people were staring at me because a veteran was out there, and they were paying homage to the American military state. And apparently I wasn't quick enough to my feet, you know, in these rituals of nationalism and patriotism and militarism. Now, it's just that I don't remember this when I was a kid, but as I got older, I noticed that they're constantly trotting out of the military onto ball fields, on football gridirons, onto baseball diamonds, onto hockey ice rinks. So they're being very political about it. They're being very political when they fly F-16 fighter jets over the 50-yard line before games start, when they make everyone pay homage before. It seems like every NHL game now, you've got to have people in military uniform trotted out there. Now, you know, in football, the issue that Kaepernick raised is something that actually probably a lot of NFL football players know about. I don't know how many Americans know that 70%, I mean 70%, nearly three-fourths of the NFL rosters now are African Americans. And I would bet you that close to every one of those NFL players could tell you a story about an unpleasant incident with a police officer in their biographies, in their earlier lives, in their current lives. There was a guy in Las Vegas, a current NFL football player, that had a terrible incident with the Las Vegas police recently. And so they know about this. They know that Kaepernick is really onto something here, that there is this endemic problem of a police state that just shoots young black men down, beats young black men up. It doesn't just shoot them, it strangles them. Eric Garner was strangled to death. The fellow in Baltimore, Freddie Gray, was killed with a rough ride with handcuffs behind his back, being driven around in a police van in Baltimore. There's all kinds of ways that they kill people. Usually they shoot them, you know, and it's endemic. And there's one of these every 28 hours, and usually the cops who shoot them get exonerated. And that's what Kaepernick was taking a knee about, this repeated killing of young black men and then the exoneration of their killers. It's not very complicated. And I think a lot of the black athletes in the NFL, which is a sport where whites want, the 90% plus white crowds in NFL football stadiums, just want these people to keep their mouths shut, these black athletes, and to continue to destroy each other's brains with high-speed, head-on Roman Coliseum-style collisions for their entertainment. Entertain us. Be happy that you have great big salaries. So NFL football players don't last much more than 3 or 4 years, but take your money and shut up and entertain us. And here's this courageous act by Colin Kaepernick saying, no, I will not pay homage to the symbol of this nation that shoots black young men down. Good for him.
Yeah, Trump ignited, though, the bonfire, the simmering resentment, the anger in not just black communities, but in amongst the whole sort of liberal, mushy liberal set about police impunity and what to do about it. But Trump, in fact, ignited the bonfire, and then the players had to respond. And they did in various ways. I think we should talk about that, but let's give us a sense of what Trump did in his craziness.
Well, no, so, okay, now Trump goes down to Alabama, the Friday before the weekend that Hurricane Maria is going to devastate Puerto Rico. And he's giving a political speech on behalf of his chosen candidate in the Republican primary down there, but he's really speaking to his red meat base. I mean, these are the whites of Alabama and Mississippi in the South are really the core of his ultimate sort of white nationalist base. And he makes sure to get in a shot at some of the black athletes who are following Kaepernick and showing some protests at the anthem. And he said, wouldn't it be just great if one of the owners, of course all the owners are white, you know, this is also racially coded, right, would tell these sons of bitches that they're going to disrespect our nation. And how badly did Trump really want to put the word black before he said sons of bitches? But even he knew he couldn't do that. He would probably get more applause in Alabama if he'd said black before he said sons of bitches. But he said, what if one of these owners, wouldn't it be great if one of these owners would tell these sons of bitches who disrespect our nation?
And our flag, right. Yeah,
get your flag for disrespecting our flag. And, of course, they cheered uproariously, and that only worsened it for him. And of course, these players are not questioning the flag per se. They're not necessarily denouncing the nation state as a whole, but they're saying as long as this particular nation state seems to think it's okay to just shoot down young black men and exonerate them. And by the way, we recently had an exoneration of a white killer cop in St. Louis just a few weeks ago that elicited some protests outside the St. Louis Cardinals baseball Busch Stadium in downtown St. Louis. You know, though, you just keep killing people and exonerating them, we're going to make this very modest. They're not burning a flag. They're kneeling, okay? They're taking a knee, which is still almost kind of looks like homage to me. But they're qualifying their nationalism by trying to draw attention to this issue of police state brutality. It's a very, very real issue. And, of course, Trump has sort of changed the conversation by saying that they're disrespecting the flag completely, disrespecting the troops, blah, blah, blah. And actually, that kind of works with a fair part of the white population.
Yeah. He
unfortunately,
also,
it also helped distract attention from Puerto Rico, which is this incredible crime of his slow response to Puerto Rico. And people have been talking about this, and it's helped distract people from his Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, and he also, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Bill Resnick talking to Paul Street, who writes a lot of interesting stuff. Look it up in the internet and books and articles. Paul, it also, it seems to me, it distracts, and there's a lot of critique in the black press about it. It distracts attention from the critique of police impunity and murder, and all sorts of actually demands for obedience for young black kids. Is sort of the policing and very aggressive policing demanding obedience in black communities, or you'll get beat up and maybe arrested and held and on high bail, ruining your life if you don't show obedience. It seems to me, though, it distracts from that, and it became sort of a freedom of speech issue, which is important. I'm not saying it's not important. I think it is, especially nowadays in Trumpism. But the freedom of speech issue is only one of them, and a lot of the players, that was their... And a lot of the white players, and of course the league owners, their first response was, "Well, we had players are human beings, are also have private lives, and they can speak out, and they have the right to do it under our Constitution, and we honor that right." And that was the extent of, it seems to me, the support that at the beginning was shown, and that completely distracted from the police impunity question.
Well, you know, it's not just police impunity. I saw a fellow on CNN, I'm forgetting his name right now, an African-American athlete on the Philadelphia Eagles, and I believe he was a safety, and he was an incredibly eloquent spokesperson.
This guy, Malcolm Jenkins.
Not just impunity. But he talked about the whole nature of the criminal justice system right now. And he talked about racially disparate mass incarceration, the ridiculous lifelong crippling mark of a felony record, which plagues one in three black males in this country right now. And he talked about the hundreds of thousands of mostly black Americans that rot in jail every night for the simple crime of not being able to afford bail, right?
Right.
The whole bail lockup. So there's more to it than just the police impunity. There's a broader sense of
the criminal justice system,
the whole criminal justice system, and in fact the society. And you know, I'm not sure entirely what you were saying that the owners were saying, but if anyone is saying, well, you have free speech rights and you can do whatever you want off the job in your real lives, but that on football Sunday, you know, this is a non-political space.
They're trying to do that now, right?
Yeah, that's nonsense, because that space is loaded up with patriotic messaging. I mean, there were reports that came out about the relationship between the Pentagon and the NFL and the war promotion and the patriotism promotion and the militarism promotion that is just routine at sporting events now. So it's a very political space, you know? And, I don't know. There's a kind of authoritarian politics about mass spectator sports themselves in the first place. And football has a lot of issues that really ought to be thought of in terms of political. It turns out these guys are wrecking their bodies and wrecking their brains in this extremely savage sport. And not just in spectacular hits, but on every single hike, these guys are crushing each other's brains, and it's showing up with CTE. Are all kinds of other horrible things. Football is a very political issue, and we have real questions of whether we want to keep playing football in this country, or is it just too dangerous?
I read that the black speaker wrote, and with a number of other players, including Michael Bennett and several others who have been very outspoken about the criminal justice system, they wrote a platform, and I read the platform, 10 pages or so. It's extremely respectful and patient. It doesn't even mention racism about the criminal justice system. It talks about the policies that disadvantage blacks. In some ways, they bent over backwards, begging the owners and others to please intervene and stop the killing and also stop the destruction of so many lives by the system that labels them criminals and makes it impossible to get a job for very large numbers of people.
A felony record is sort of the last remaining openly permissible form of complete discrimination.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell are people supposed to do in a capitalist society when they can't get a job? Because on the job application, you have to mark whether you have a felony record again, and you wonder why people go back to crime and just permanently recycle through the criminal justice system. So if they were raising that issue, that's an important
issue. No, it's great. There's no question that that was important.
Yeah.
What was markedly, though, about that document, they didn't talk really about the need for opportunity for people for decent living wage work amongst the bottom 30%. And which is what the system is protecting, this sort of system of reserve army of labor. It's sort of a slave system with a different...
Well, if you don't confront the underlying socioeconomic status and the intimately related problem of segregation and just the concentration. I mean, there are 10 neighborhoods in Chicago where half of the kids are growing up in less than half of the notoriously inadequate federal poverty level, and every one of them is 90% or more black. And you have similar situations in the inner cities of every major in the country. And that's sort of the underlying socioeconomic and simultaneously racial political economy on which this criminal justice system is built. And I agree with you. The other area that I find a lot of the players protest too tame is on the question of foreign policy. And so what Kaepernick and others will get the criticism again and again and again, and I think it's an absurd, but they get the criticism that you are disrespecting our troops and you're disrespecting our military, which, you know, and then there's always the additional statement, which is defending our freedom around the world, you know, which is just complete and total nonsense. But the athletes, either they don't want to, or they have politically calculated that they can't respond in a forthright fashion to that criticism. So they make this point of saying, we don't mean any disrespect to our troops, we don't mean any disrespect to the military. Well, gee whiz, you know, I'm a leftist, why not, okay? This military eats up 55% of federal discretionary spending, it maintains more than 900 military bases spread across more than 900 countries. We are never going to have progress on the social issues that are tearing this country apart. The mass poverty, the mass lack of health care, the people who can't afford health care, you know, the ghettoization and the barrios and the reservations, the mass poverty in this deeply unequal country. You know, as long as the Pentagon system is sucking up the vast lion's share of federal discretionary spending, like this Dr. King used to talk about, the big destructive suction tube of the war state. And they're not defending anybody's freedom. I mean, somebody explain to me how blowing up Libya or destroying the state of Iraq, invading Iraq, or the stationing of troops across Eastern Europe is defending my freedom. It's doing no such thing.
Yeah, it would be great.
Advancing empire. They don't want to say that. They don't want to talk about that. I get it that they don't, right? They don't want to get in more trouble than they already are. But if we really want to be honest about it, we can't just give ground
right.
on military.
Paul, you know, one final thing, and I think I'm just going to steal the last word because we're out of time, but Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did an interesting piece. It was hardly radical, but he's really a thoughtful guy in many ways, but his piece was, this is a great opportunity for talking to people with sports as the base, but really talking about how this country operates and the responsibility to, in fact, protest and around what. And he understands the political economy at the roots of things. Anyway, we can talk about that again or other people. Anyway, Paul Street, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Super, you bet. We'll talk later.
Right, so
bye-bye.
Long.
That, of course, was Jimi Hendrix's version of the Star Spangled Banner. Hendrix performed this at Woodstock during the height of the war on Vietnam. Hendrich's interpretation appears to be mostly about U.S. war making and dropping bombs on terrorized people. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Part 1. The new documentary film First Daughter and the Black Snake kicked off the 5th annual Portland Echo Film Festival hosted by the Hollywood Theater this weekend under the directorship of Don Smallman. First Daughter, directed by Carrie Pickett, features an environmental activist, writer, and executive director of Honor the Earth, Winona LaDuke. The film documents the struggle to stop Enbridge Energy's proposed new oil pipeline, which threatens sacred wild rice lakes in northern Minnesota. Both Carrie Pickett and Winona LaDuke were in attendance for the screening and post-film discussion. Old Mole Denise Morris recorded the event. This segment highlights the challenges and rewards in the fight against building oil pipelines on tribal lands.
Thanks again, everybody, for watching that pretty pitched four-year battle against that line. You saw that thing turned out and everything. You know, and we prayed, and in the end, we did win that battle. You know, we got some of that so that was, pretty remarkable itself. But then they did buy that 28% of the Dakota Access Pipeline. You know, and they bolstered up Energy Transfer Partners that wasn't really able to, they needed that money. You know, so we hold that corporation responsible. So they came back with a now bigger pipeline, which is this Tarzan's pipeline, 915,000 barrels a day. And so we're in a very pitched battle, same corridor. They wanted to bust this whole new corridor, and it's called Line 3. And so we've been in this battle. Over this last year, we're doing a lot of work on the ground. The regulatory hearings, there's a big meeting today, a regulatory hearing in Minneapolis, so you're seeing some of the same thing play out. A couple things just to say is, one is that we do have a decent shot at it. So for the same reason the rest of you are looking at these fossil fuel infrastructures, you're looking at the end of the fossil fuel era. You're looking at extreme extraction up in the tar sands. Very expensive. You guys all know this stuff, right? So we're just going to keep fighting them, and we're going to push them back. That's our intention. And what I will say is that our people are camping. I've been telling this to people around the country. If you miss the opportunity to get arrested at Standing Rock, in the spring is when the state of Minnesota may issue that permit. In the spring or summer, very nice camping season in Minnesota. Look at our website, honortheearth, or stoplinefree.org. I will say that 2 weeks ago, the state of Minnesota did surprise us, that Department of Commerce, with all those guys that were kind of bored with us, they issued an opinion that said that this pipeline, there was no need for this pipeline. So please, keep a look on our website and support us on Honor the Earth. It's brutal. It's a brutal battle. Like my people, it's brutal out there. I have to say, on the ground, it's hard on us. But we did, we did have a split. The other thing I want to say is that some of you guys are Standing Rock this year. Thank you for coming out there. I just want to give one more update, which is that the North Dakota Supreme Court is thinking to pull back the it's called ad hoc probici, which is the ability of out-of-state lawyers to represent water protectors. So they were requested until October 2nd. If you look on our website, Water Protection Legal Fund, until October 2nd, you can comment and say, hey, water protectors do deserve the right to good counsel. Okay. Right? So please do that. Like justice for our water protectors, and thank you all for being water protectors.
I have a question for Winona. You're the only person I've ever felt happy about voting for in a presidential election. Any plans for a future running for public office?
I'm going to really just work hard in Minnesota. I think about it a lot. I think about this moment that we're in and what we can all do. What is the best thing for us to do? And for me, working really hard on this battle for the create the next economy. That's what I want to do. I had a conversation I have a really big project. You all appreciate this coming from Oregon. I have a Kickstarter that is launching this next week for Winona's Hemp. Also because I am one of the 26 people in Minnesota who has an industrial hemp permit. And so I want to build the next economy. I'm really tired of this one. Y'all tired of this one? I'm new on. I just want to be part of that. Even the Enbridge Corporation, they have a $7 billion renewable energy portfolio. And I tell them at every meeting, I'm like, why don't you guys just do renewables? We'd like you a lot better. You know what I'm saying? It's time to move on. So that's what I've been working on. But you can look up the Winona's Hemp Kickstarter and as we get going, I've never done that before, but that's my plan.
Thank you again for all the work that you do, Winona. We are about to face a pipeline fight of our own in Southern Oregon. The third incarnation of the Pacific Connector Pipeline is about to, well, they just filed for their permits, and so those processes are undergoing. And I just wonder if you could give us some advice as we get ready to wage battle against the Black Snake.
You know, we have a long history of working and defeating stupid projects, right? Just keep that up. You know what I'm saying is that these are really stupid infrastructure projects. It's not that I'm opposed to pipelines. I like water and sewer. I think they're fabulous. You know what I'm saying is we've got a decent infrastructure in the country, and we're trying to build a bunch of pipelines for oil companies. That makes no sense. You need people being put to work building infrastructure for people. Right? And, you know, I'm going to stick to that. We need to change the discussion, and we need to keep pushing so that we have a more light discussion. In the meantime, we just need to keep pushing because everybody in this room knows the longer you fight them, the less likely it is for that project to go forward. The other thing that we all know is that I don't want to spend my life saying, I don't want this. I want to say, this is what we want to do. You know? And we got a way better idea. And like at some level, I feel like that they took a lot of the political system, they cheated, they took a lot of the political system, but they did not take the economic system. You know, we can talk about a lot of pieces, but even the divestment movement, you know what I'm saying, is that there's a lot of movement away from fossil fuels, and we just need to keep pushing it so that these pipelines make no sense to anybody. So you guys have done a really good job in these battles, so I just keep encouraging you to keep doing it, because it's worth everything to protect our land.
When all of the authorities were coming in with that viciousness, can you explain how fascism raised its ugly head?
You're talking about Standing Rock?
Standing Rock.
Yeah. Okay, so about a third of the cases have been dismissed or acquitted. You know, it's just ridiculous, the charges, and everybody knows that. You know, the charge for prey, you're charged with rioting, right? And so there is the water protection legal defense, but there is the first case of the civil case against North Dakota has a hearing on October 18th in St. Paul in the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. And that is the excessive force cases. Because everybody in here will agree that you don't get to shoot people with rubber bullets and water cannons and try to injure them in this, you know, for our First Amendment rights. And so that first case, which is the Vanessa Dundeen case of excessive force, is going to be heard on October 18th. It is an appeal as to if the case can even be heard, you know, because it's really stacked against us. But I'm, you know, in that system. But Honor the Earth is committed to the civil cases because we believe, we know that what North Dakota did was wrong, and they should be held accountable. As you heard, since the corporation Enbridge financed a third of that pipeline, our position is that, you know, because I called them, I texted them, I wrote them letters. Sounds like a dysfunctional relationship, but I said, you gotta stop. You gotta stop shooting us. You gotta stop putting the dogs on us, Enbridge. You know, because you're trying to act all sweet to us over here. This is not the work. And so we hold them accountable. We hold them responsible for a third of the injuries. They'll be responsible for a third of the bullets and a third of the tanks. You know, so whole corporations accountable for their interests. They sustain, and you know, you cannot let this corporation go forward with that. But at the same time, watch what's going on with the civil case. The civil cases, they're a little ways out, but the first one is in a bar mob in Minnesota. So thank you for, and keep, you must keep vigilant, because North Dakota should not be able to allow to do that, be allowed to do that.
I just want to draw attention to that pipeline in Southern Oregon. You can add your name to a letter or a petition online to make the Army Corps of Engineers aware that you post the liquefied natural gas terminal in Coos Bay, the just called Jordan Cove project. And right now the Army Corps of Engineers is considering giving a permit to allow dredging in Coos Bay, which will widen the shipping lane for these ships to come in and take the liquefied natural gas to other countries. It's Rogue River, riverkeeper.org. Thank you.
Right now in Minnesota, you know, Enbridge says it'll cost $1.8 billion to clean up the old line, and that's not hardware. So we're like, that's labor, guys. You know what I'm saying? But there's like so much push on the labor unions to say, you know, we just build this pipe. I mean, it's like, I feel like they're building pipelines to nowhere. I mean, they're just building so they can have this short set of jobs. You know, I've seen some turn on that. I've seen some people say they get it. You know, and a lot of those people, to be honest, I think that they just want a job. And so I feel like we really need to say we need jobs for pipe fitters. But those would be, you know, those would be fixing things that need to be fixed, right? And right now in Minnesota, there's 300 miles of pipe from a pipeline that's never going to be built, the Sandpiper, right? And so what I tell the state of Minnesota and Enbridge like once a week is, you should send those pipes to Flint.
Thank you all for sharing your visions and stories with us tonight. It was really inspiring to me, especially as a young Native woman from Santa Clara Pueblo in New Mexico. Out there, we've been continuing the struggle against the rampant proliferation of fracking wells on our ancestral homelands in the greater Chaco region. This is a struggle that has been happening for decades on decades, but was recently reignited by our tribal youth. And so I was just wondering for Winona, what's your advice to our younger generations who are choosing to engage in these struggles and fights against these fossil fuel monsters?
I love you guys so much. You know, I have a lot of privilege in my life, and I get to go to, you know, different colleges and see a lot of young Native youth, and I was just down in Flagstaff with a lot of Native youth, you know, listening to a lot of these stories and what's going on. And, you know, I mean, I was your age, you know, I've been at this for 40 years, pretty much, and, you know, you put your good heart out there, you find people that are thinking these things, and you keep working. And I have to say that the Dene territory, I mean, you guys, I really think you guys need to change. I think you need to run a slate of candidates for your Dene government, if you're now. Because that is a really big, you know, that's 85% of the economy of the Navajo Nation comes from fossil fuels. They have an economy that needs to transition. They passed the Green Economies Act, but now they just passed it to begin implementing it, right? You know, I'd be on a full court press to start moving. They also have more solar than anybody in the country, but they have more fossil fuels. You know, it's a really crazy thing, but most of those fossil fuels are going throughout the Southwest for Albuquerque. So, you know, organize your youth, go out and, you know, work in those, in the process. Act your tribe is what I would call me at. And then I would just keep pushing for this next economy. And it's a pitched battle, and it's just down there. You know, and a lot of our prayers are with you down there to protect Chaco Canyon. You know, and all of your territory. We get some beautiful territory and some crazy corporations. So, thank you and really good luck.
Thank you so much,
Jordan. Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country. darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rope. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart.
That was Buffy St. Marie, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. You're listening to the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now Jan Hawken and psychoanalyst Bob Samuels are here to discuss the new film Mother, directed by Darren Aronofsky. Aronofsky describes the film as a dreamscape, as well as an allegorical study of destructive male narcissism. Hawken and Samuels discuss the images in the film and how we might think of them in the context of the current nightmare we're living under in the Trump era.
Bob Samuels, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you.
Bob Samuels teaches writing at UC Santa Barbara and is president of UC's American Federation of Teachers. He's author of 7 books, including his recent Psychoanalyzing the Left and Right After Donald Trump. Well, we'll be putting politics on the couch today and making sense of the madness of the Trump era. But Bob Samuels, let's start with the movies and Darren Aronofsky's new film, Mother. Most moviegoers seem to hate the film, while many critics defend it, particularly what's described as his brilliant dreamscapes. So let's talk about the dream imagery and logic in this film. Before tuning into the nightmare of our times, can you give a synopsis of Mother? What's the basic plot?
So Jennifer Lawrence plays a woman who has a baby and is married to a very self-involved poet. She tries to rebuild his old house that was destroyed in a fire, but her attempt to create a perfect home is undermined when her husband allows a mysterious couple and fans of his work into the house. A nightmare of violence and anxiety follows. So that's my two-sentence kind of reductive plot summary, but the movie is so much more than that.
Well, there are a lot of films that draw on this, the illusion of the home as sanctuary, and even with this gothic turn toward a domestic refuge, a kind of mansion on a lonely hill that destroys the heroine, a wife under the control of a maniacal husband. It's been done in literature and films before. What does Aronofsky bring to this that interests you?
So on one level, what he's doing, I think, is he said, and other people have said, is an allegory for climate change, and basically saying that it's man's, and you can say it's masculine, but man in general, humans in general, self-obsession that is basically destroying the planet. And so this kind of allegory of the planet being destroyed by humans who are super self-involved is combined with this family drama of basically a woman being married to a self-obsessed man who basically ignores all her interests and keeps on inviting people into the house that she is working so hard to perfect and build. And at the same time, the metaphors that he uses are all from the Bible and kind of follow the movement from the Old Testament to the New Testament, with like a Garden of Eden scene first, and then basically the Adam and Eve come and they eat from the apple, and then we get floods, we get overpopulation, we get basically a son born, a son sacrificed, we get revelation, apocalypse, fire, pestilence, flood. And so I think there's at least 3 different levels that the film is working on, and the problem is I think the audiences generally have a hard time dealing with those 3 levels, and they're used to kind of easy entertainment and kind of a one-dimensional movie, and here he's trying to operate on multiple levels at the same time. And then the 4th level is that this is all like a nightmare, a dream, and so people complain, why is Jennifer Lawrence just staring there? Why isn't, for the first half of the film? But the idea is like in a dream, you really don't know what's happening. You have no control. And so you're kind of like Jennifer Lawrence, where you're just like staring at these unpredictable things happening to you. And I think it really does give a sense of the dream and the feelings that people have in a dream, especially an anxiety dream or nightmare. And people just don't have a tolerance now for like the unconscious, for symbolism, for dreams, and in general for psychoanalysis. And
yeah, let me defend the stupid moviegoers for a moment here. I think psychoanalytically, would you agree that a difference between a crazy person and a gifted artist is their ability to understand an audience, how their ideas and images and a very obscure meanings or numerologies or symbols that mean something to you could open up an interpretive and creative space that other people can connect with. And it seemed to me that this was at times an example of a narcissistic filmmaker, maybe even Aronofsky himself, because I appreciate how early on in the film there are some wonderful and very funny examples of this breaking through of scary imagery into into reality. But it also became so, in my mind, kind of over the top, flooded with imagery without enough of a kind of containing interpretive frame of any kind. So you could say any artist can throw imagery out there, but what makes it hold together in some way that other people can relate to?
Well, I think one of the questions is, you know, what is the role of art in today's politics? Because if you think of climate change, we have, you know, 95% of scientists agree that we're basically destroying our own environment. But people don't really seem to care or be willing to do anything about it. So, like, reason and science and information doesn't seem to be working. And so I think, like, as an artist, the idea is, well, how do we kind of affect people on another level? If reason's not working, how do we affect them emotionally, or how do we affect them psychologically? And so it's a very kind of distracting and disorienting film, but I think that's part of the idea, and it may or may not work. It may be a bad idea, but the idea is, well, how do we disrupt people from their normal way of seeing the world and seeing themselves, and how do we put them in a different kind of mental state? And clearly it didn't work for a lot of people, at least on a conscious level it didn't work, but I think that's the idea of, like, what kind of art can we have in this age of kind of irrational politics?
Well, continuing with that thought, the film ends in a very bleak way, and the mother, the Jennifer Lawrence figure, and I still can't quite figure out why it's not the wife exclamation mark instead of the mother exclamation mark, but she is a victim, but has made a kind of deal with the devil. And so I think to the extent that we are supposed to identify with her and her lethal fate, what, you know, she's quite passive and seems to willingly participate in protecting this husband who becomes a religious figure for followers and ultimately her undoing. It's clearly a cautionary tale, but as a feminist, I'm always interested in what happens with the female protagonist beyond being a victim. What's your take on that?
I think the biggest problem politically with the film is that it does fall back on this very old metaphor of Mother Earth. And
yeah.
So using mother, it's not called wife because it's about Mother Earth and this idea she's becoming a mother, but also she represents Mother Earth, and she's basically being raped and destroyed by the men. And that's the metaphor that they've used.
And so she's kind of a cipher for all these things, a vehicle for other things.
Right. But she's the connection point between like three different narratives, the kind of the biblical narrative, the kind of modern family narrative, you might think, and then the climate change narrative. And so she represents Mother Earth and the mother, right? And so she has to play those multiple roles, which is very difficult and challenging. But, you know, what this makes me think of, like, the need for us to really teach, like, psychoanalysis in the schools, because I find, like, in our culture, one problem people have with politics right now is they don't really have a way of talking about the kind of irrationality of politics. I mean, we know that there's these irrational things, like people always vote for the same party no matter what. Trump says he could shoot people in the street and his voters would still support him. But we really don't learn a lot about, like, emotions, about the unconscious, about symbolism. And so we constantly try to force something into a rational discourse and a rational dialogue. And we don't really educate people about, like, how emotions work, how the unconscious works. And because of kind of like the demonization and dismissive of psychoanalysis, especially for like the drug treatment kind of industry, people are not given the tools to how to think symbolically or to think about emotions or to think allegorically.
About disturbing aspects of mind, you're saying, that get quieted with or subdued with medication for the most part.
Yes, and not just of mind, but of culture. I mean, the whole, I think, right-wing... One thing I would just want to say about Trump is, and I just was reading a book that kind of supports my viewpoint...
It's always helpful.
Yes.
It's always
Trump really is not... The Democrats have made a tremendous mistake. They've kind of represented Trump as an aberration. When Trump really represents the culmination of 40 years of kind of irrational conservative rhetoric. I mean, they have attacked the government, right? And so he is like the amateur, because basically they've been saying that the government is the problem and not the solution. He is like the epitome of kind of money in politics. He's the epitome of like of indirect racism and coded racism and unconscious messaging. And I see his Twitter feed as kind of like his free association, his public free association, kind of like revealing all of these hidden or indirect aspects of the Republican Party. And so I think he's serving a function that way. But the problem is people don't know how to deal with like the irrational foundations of our politics. And so they keep on trying to put it into a rational discourse.
Well, early on, Trump was described by many as the id of the Republican Party. But I think you're saying even that tends to downplay it's more than just the unrestrained impulses of conservatives, right-wing people, but more into kind of the ego, if you want to go that direction, the ego structure itself.
Well, just like the big strategy really for 40 years has been, how do wealthy elites turn themselves into the victims of society? And what they've done is they've used the culture war. So the wealthy elites like Trump, they're victims of the media. They're victims of political correctness. They're victims of liberal culture. And so they've used a culture war to hide the true class warfare, the fact that wealthy are getting so much wealthier and everyone else is staying the same or losing wealth. And so they're constantly doing a misdirection of focusing on cultural conflict. And so they like it every time the news concentrates on like Charlottesville or you know, a racial conflict or political correctness. That's what they want, because they want everyone to focus on a cultural conflict so that they can keep their powerful positions in society.
It seems, would this be consistent with the way Trump is framed as a fighter, too? So Sarah Huckabee says, when he's hit, he hits back. And, you know, growing up, boys are told, you know, you get punched, you punch back. And I'm not sure if that's quite the same as being a victim, but I think this idea of the idealizing of the fighter who, when he's, you know, hits back, is that kind of someone along the lines of victim? It seems to me it's more like being a defiant fighter.
Well, if you think of like the structure of narcissism, I think people really misunderstand it. They think it's just the egoism, right? The grandiosity.
Yeah.
But underlying it is this sense of like a lack of self, a lack of self-esteem, right? And also this idea that because they're in a victim position, any vengeance or revenge is justified. And so, like, you know, for me, the epitome is he goes to Texas after a tornado. And the first thing he says, what a great crowd. How many people are here to see me? And it's like so focused on himself. And then when people like criticize him, then he just lashes out at the media. He lashes out at the true victims of the event, like what's going on in Puerto Rico. And so I think that, you know, this need that he has, this desperate need to constantly be recognized and to be seen as great. Like, it's not only make America great again, it's make Donald Trump great again and again. And so he lashes out whenever anyone criticizes. But that lashing out is part of the larger Republican strategy of focusing on the media, on political correctness, and liberal culture as the true problem in society. So the problem is not wealth inequality or the corruption of politics. The problem is that the liberal elites make us feel bad for our racism and our sexism.
And then I think getting back to the film, there is this dilemma around the fascination with the narcissist, although in clinical terms, narcissism, and this is my hope for the future, it gets really old, and people who are extreme narcissists become over time quite boring and predictable. The emptiness becomes more apparent. And I think we're seeing this with the Trump phenomenon, and yet there's a fascination, and that's part of the idea Aronofsky was working with, and the mother, the fascination with a kind of empty showmanship in the realm of politics. And so in closing today, I also want to encourage our listeners to get your book. There's more to be said on psychoanalyzing the Trump era and your focus, not just on the pathology of Trump, but the pathology of a society that is fascinated and enables someone like him. So thanks for being with us today, Bob Samuels, and we'll have a link to your book, Psychoanalyzing the Left and Right After Donald Trump, on our website. That'll be available later in the week. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks again.
And now Bill Resnick has some comments on the tragedy that occurred in Las Vegas last night. Bill's getting settled in the studio, and he'll be with us in just a moment.
Hi, folks. This mass murder in Las Vegas at the country music festival and concert, the shooter was killed. I'm sure it'll come out what motivated him or his background. It appears to be a 64-year-old white man who lived in the Las Vegas exurbs, which, of course, is Bundy and militia territory. But who knows what his grievances were or his motives. In any event, regardless of this guy's particular affiliations, there's plenty of blame to go around. Why did it happen? There's, of course, Trump will be blamed, his incendiary rhetoric calling for violence against protesters and legitimating violence. There'll, of course, be all the Nazis and white supremacists, at least in the left press, that will be traced to them, and they, of course, bear some responsibility. There's, of course, the right-wing radio and Fox News, their nonstop anger-stoking and the stuff on the Internet and attacking big government and attacking the big government, stealing your money, giving it to blacks and other undeserving people, and taking your guns and freedom. The NRA really bears a lot of responsibility. It's not just their insistence on selling automatic rifles. And then there's the militiamen and the Bundy types, but there's also the whole neoliberal establishment of the 1% who have created an economy of downward mobility and anxiety and fear among large groups of people, and also the entertainment industry basically dishonors traditional values, much of it. There's some that doesn't, but it dishonors traditional values and traditional people. There's a lot of people who are really angry and feel betrayed and feel lost and anxious. And some of them, and guns are available, and that's what happens. Anyway, you're not going to hear much of that critique. That is the critique of American political economy and what's happening to most people. But you can hear it on KBOO. That's what we talk about, organizing the many, many millions of people who are dispossessed and angry and giving them a different vision of what a good society could look like and how they can achieve it. Anyway, that's all for the old mole today, I guess. Tom's going to sign off. Thank you.
Well, as Bill said, that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs.